Thank you. 12 in the middle, and then the coffee break is at 5. Yeah. Way of technology transfer or
So welcome to the afternoon session of the FOSA School. It's really a pleasure to have here with us Professor Jan Judens from the University of Dortmund, Technical University of Dortmund, and also from Offer ISD.
Professor Judens is one of the pioneers of modern human security,
and is the topic of the talk of security, the unique author of the textbook, one of the landmark textbooks in the area, that is system development in general. So we look forward to
thank you for the introduction. It was very much indeed for the opportunity to present this summer school lecture. Let's just start right ahead. You can skip the introduction because you already introduced me. Only I should mention that I am very happy to be back here at Berlino and at Bossart for my third time actually. So Bossart has been has accompanied me in my complete career, more or less. I was here at Bossart 2001, I think the first edition actually, as a participant when I was still a PhD student. Then I came back in 2004 as a postdoc to give a lecture, and now I'm here again. So I'm very happy, of course, that I can deliver this lecture as well. So I don't need to spend too much time on motivation because, of course, we've already had a couple of very good lecture courses which already provide this motivation. So basically, I don't have to say much about this slide here. Security is important. There are lots of challenging problems, and this is also what this lecture will be about. Maybe a bit more specifically, the point of view that I'm taking in this lecture may be compared to the other lectures in the summer school is that basically I'm going to assume that we have some security mechanisms and I let other people worry about making them actually secure. And the goal of this lecture is to try to develop a software engineering method, which allows software developers to securely use the security mechanism in a system context. So, of course, we have lots of security mechanisms, such as cryptography, cryptographic protocols, etc. But unfortunately, the situation in practice is still that many systems are insecure. And the reason from our point of view is that it's actually quite hard to use this kind of security mechanisms correctly, and we're trying to develop an approach which helps software developers with this challenging task. And this is what I'm trying to visualize in this picture here. What you can see there is actually security mechanism, namely a bar which blocks streets. And as you can see, this security mechanism has not been broken. It is actually secure itself. Unfortunately, it's not very securely embedded into the system context, because as you can see at the marks on the grass, the cars have simply been driving around the gates, and so that's the usual problem that you have with IT security in practice today. We have lots of strong security mechanisms, strong cryptography and cryptographic protocols, etc., but we still have insecure systems, and part of the reason is what is visualized in that picture. And so a bit more motivation, although this is almost not necessary now after, you know, we are already a couple of lectures into the summer school, but a couple of examples of what I mean by that security is difficult. Classical problem in early versions of Unix. One of the early versions, there was the problem that when you log into the system came back with the error message when you provided the wrong password. As soon as it detected the first digit in the password which was wrong. So it compared the password character by character to the stored password, and as soon as the first character was wrong, it came back with the error message. And of course, if you're able to measure that time precisely enough, then you can reduce the search space that you have to try out from 20 to the end, 26 to the end, assuming that we use 26 letters for simplicity, and n is the password length, down to 26 times n. By a simple algorithm, you just try the first character first. You have 26 possibilities for that. You can find out which one is the first by just trying all of them and measuring how much time the system needs to come back with an error message, and then you continue one after the other, and that way you get down from 26 to the end to 26 times n, which of course is a much smaller number, and this way the system becomes insecure. So this is a typical example which, from the looking at this problem from the point of view of practice, I would have to say this is kind of problem you're not going to find by typical performance testing, which is the usual quality assurance technique that is still used today in practice in the context of software engineering and software development. This kind of problem you're not going to find by testing, and this motivates the kind of research that I'm going to present in this lecture. Of course, the first example is already a couple of years old, but the second example is a bit more recent. And this shows a similar problem in the situation of smart cars, where suddenly, I think in 96, so already also a couple of years ago, Paul Cohen, I believe, first demonstrated that it's actually possible to get out secret information from a smart card, like a cryptographic key, by measuring the power consumption that the smart card consumes while performing cryptographic operations. Of course, that was a very surprising result, and before we came up with that result, no one would have guessed that this would be possible. And again, something, looking at the problem from the point of view as a practical software developer, this is something you're not going to find by classical testing. So that's the kind of motivation for our work, and even more use of cryptography, of course. Cryptography is very important in security critical systems, one of the main tools to make systems secure. And again, you run into problems if you now want to do quality assurance in practice, which is still mostly testing. The question is, how can you test systems that use cryptography exhaustively if cryptography is supposed to be secure against brute force attacks? Because if you were able to test a system exhaustively that uses cryptography, exhaustively in the extreme sense that you really test every possible key and every possible random value, then this would amount to brute force attack, which should not be possible. So therefore, this cannot work by principal reasons. So lots of motivation why in the case of developing security critical software, you cannot just use the usual software development and quality assurance techniques that are used in practice today, but you have to use something stronger than that. And a concrete example, which I will come back later to and tomorrow as a practical application example, is one example we actually looked at with our approach, namely that of a biometric authentication system, which includes an authentication protocol as well, which is pictured on that slide. Of course, you cannot see the details here, but just to show that these kind of systems, even though we only look at the core part of the system, are already quite complex. And this means that you cannot find problems just by looking at the system very hard and trying to find problems, but you really need some good methods and good tools that support the real process. And again, of course, the motivation I've been providing just now could have been the motivation also for other courses in the summer school to some degree, more or less, with different emphasis. But what I really want to try to emphasize on in this lecture now is the, as I said, the embedding this kind of work into a software development process, which is reasonably to be actually used in practice, and this means trying to embed these kind of techniques into a software development method which is actually used in practice today. So that's basically the goal of our research and the goal of what I want to present in this lecture, again, to integrate advanced methods for providing security assurance into a software development method which is actually realistic to be used in practice, in software development practice today, or there is at a near point in the future. So that's basically our goal, and what the approach that we build on to achieve that goal is the approach of model-based software development, which you may have heard about already, which of course is used quite a bit also outside security. It is a sort of mainstream software development approach, and this is something we are going to build on in this lecture and try to target this kind of software development approach for the case of security critical software. And in particular, making heavy use of tools in order to achieve that goal. On the one hand, practically usable tools, on the other hand, also we still have the goal that this should be theoretically sound, so even though we have quite a lot of practical motivation, on the other hand, we still have the motivation that whatever analysis techniques we're developing and using here, we should be able to prove that this is actually sound with respect to some reasonable underlying foundational model. So that's basically the goal of our research and of what I want to present in this lecture. As I said, the approach in general is built on model-based development, and the kind of modeling approach I'm going to use in this lecture specifically is built on the unified modeling language, UML, but this is not the only artifact that we use in this approach. We also work with the source code level and analyzing source code for security requirements, and also on the configuration data level, for example, analyzing permission data. But I will come back to that, of course, in much more detail. And this slide basically summarizes the more or less the whole lecture. I will come back to this overview slide a couple of times. So, as I said, yeah, the approach builds on model-based development, so we have models at a central part of this picture, and the goal is to enforce security requirements. These are up here, and in the terms of the practical software development process, this means we want to start with the security requirements elicitation phase and help software developers with that task, and in order to make sure that they don't forget any security requirements or misinterpret security requirements. The second step, we aim to include those requirements in the models to make, firstly to document them, and secondly also to be able to automatically verify the models against those security requirements on the model level already. which has the advantage that you can remove problems before you actually start coding. Of course, that's the general idea of model-based development. Before you actually start coding, you try to document as much as possible using models, and in our case, UML models, but of course, there could also be some other modeling notation, because the earlier you find problems, the less costly it is to remove the problems, and that way you can actually save quite a lot of money. Still, of course, you need to go down to the code level. To some degree, that is actually possible by automated code generation. Of course, that saves a lot of effort and has the potential to prevent a lot of security weaknesses as well. But in many cases, you still have to code the software manually. But in that case, at least you can still generate these test sequences from the models. And of course, there's also one lecture in the summer school which goes into that topic of model-based security testing in more detail. So I will only touch on that topic very shortly in this lecture today or tomorrow. And then, finally, you're on the code level, and by linking the models to the code, you can not only analyze the models against the security requirements, but you can also make sure that the code itself is in fact secure, which of course is what the final goal is. Then, of course, sometimes you will have software which was not developed in a model-based fashion, because model-based development, well, it's been around for almost 20 years now, but obviously there's software which is even older than that, so and that is also something we want to be able to work with. So, but fortunately enough, there are also tools which you allow you to extract models from existing legacy code, and this is also something we're using. And once you do that, at the second step, you can then again analyze those models that you extracted from the code level against the security requirements. So far for the software side of things, but of course, it's not enough to statically verify the software or the models against the security requirements, but you actually want the software to be secure at runtime. And for that, you need more. You need, for example, configuration data, and by that I mean things like permissions, user permission data, for example. And the thing is, of course, even if your software is secure, but if your permission data is not defined correctly, then the overall running system will still be insecure. And therefore, we need to incorporate this information in our analysis approach and enable our tools to also reason about that. Either by generating that data automatically from the models, or conversely, if you already have the data given, then we have tools which allow you to verify the data against the models and thereby also against the security requirements. But even if you have made sure that the configurations are secure, you still cannot be 100% certain that the system will be secure at runtime. At least if you're sufficiently paranoid about that, because of course still things could go wrong. For example, the compiler could be manipulated such that the source code is in fact secure, but the compiled bytecode is not anymore secure. And of course, there's a famous Turing Award lecture quite a while ago which demonstrated how you could do that. And of course, there may be other problems. Whenever you do verification on this side, you need to make assumptions on your system and on the environment of the system in order to be able to do this verification. And these assumptions may or may not be satisfied at runtime. So there may be lots of reasons why, despite all of this effort, systems can still become insecure. And this is why we've worked on a last component in this picture, which allows us to do a runtime verification of systems for security properties in order to really make sure that at runtime the security properties will not be violated. And of course, this sounds a bit redundant. If I say, well, we also want to do runtime verification, you might say, well, why you just don't forget about the static verification then? But that's not quite true, because, well, for various reasons, I already pointed out one reason, namely that it's just less costly to remove mistakes as early in the life cycle as possible. And the other reason is, of course, if you only do runtime verification, then things might go wrong, and you might only notice them at the point when they go wrong. And of course, it's still better to find out the problems before you actually run the system by static verification compile time. So that's basically why all of these different assurance techniques have their own merit, and it makes sense to use them together, even though to some degree they may seem redundant. Last part of the picture, software evolution. This is also something I will shortly go into tomorrow, probably. This adds yet another dimension to the picture. You can really visualize that in a sort of third dimension coming out of the slide, meaning that, well, the dimension, third dimension of time, of course, which goes or driven out to the software development life cycle. And this means that at every point in time, every part of this picture might change for various reasons. Requirements may change because customers might change their mind. The models change maybe as a reaction to the changing requirements. The code might change for various reasons. The data changes, and in fact the runtime system changes. And at each point the question is whether the system will still be secure after the change. Theoretically, of course, you could just redo all of those assurance techniques to make sure that the system is still secure after the change. But of course, that would be very impractical, even though we aim for techniques which are very well usable and as far as possible automated. They are still not going to be completely automated. That's still just not feasible and not reasonable to expect. So if you had to redo all of these assurance techniques after each evolution step, then this would be clearly too much effort. So part of our work has concentrated on trying to find ways to make this more intelligent and try to be able to only verify the part of the software that actually changed against the security requirements, which unfortunately is surprisingly difficult for various reasons. For example, because security in general may not be composable, so you cannot simply concentrate on those parts of the system that has changed, because it's not in general composable, so changing one part might in fact break the security of the whole system. So lots of problems, and yeah, in this lecture today and tomorrow morning I will try to firstly provide a bit more detailed overview of model-based security engineering, and then also, time permitting, try to go into a bit more detail about some of those aspects. Then, well, the literature pointer, as Fabio already mentioned, there's a book on this topic called Secure System Development with UML. Came out at Springer a couple of years ago. And I'm happy to say that there's actually a Chinese translation of that, even though I'm in no way able to read any of it. But yeah, in case you're capable of reading Chinese, I can point you to this translation, which came out at Beijing Press in 2009. Anyway, so so much for the central picture of this lecture, which will come back quite a number of times to remind you of the whole thing. I think in terms of motivation, basically I've already said this, so goal is to integrate security assurance techniques into software development processes and to get security by design, and in particular to integrate this model-based security engineering approach into the software lifecycle, which is in use in practice today. And basically, I think I already explained that as well. But on the other hand, there's again another dimension, not only the dimension of the system lifecycle, but also that of the architectural layers. And again, there the goal is to be as integrated and complete as possible, not only to focus on various bits of this picture, but at least the long-term goal is to be able to provide an integrated approach which takes into account the various parts of this picture. And on the one hand, and this is in the various parts of the technical architectural layers, and some of them I've already mentioned, source code, models, Hardware, of course, well, we're not going to talk about hardware verification here, but we need to make assumptions on the hardware to be able to verify software and models. And then, of course, we need to make assumptions on the cryptography which is used in that software as well. And all of that is based on theoretical foundations, which we also need to take into account. But also, from the practical context point of view, we need to worry about the human users of the system. We need to be able to have ways of, for example, modeling the workflows and business processes that are going to be used together with the software that is going to be developed, because they have to be consistent. The software has to support the business processes and the security in the context of those business processes that are going to be executed. And in particular, of course, this includes the humans that will execute those business processes, but not only the actual business processes, but also the workflows that are necessary for the IT management itself. And all of that finally rests on laws and regulations, which again we have to take into account, because in the end you will always have some remaining residual risk in security, which you will be able to say that, well, this is the risk which I deal with using laws and regulations. If someone breaks the system despite all the technical machinery that I used, then finally, at least I would like to be able to go to court and get that person challenged in court. And of course, I can still try to make sure by technical means that I gather as much evidence as possible to actually be successful in that respect. But in order to be able to do that, you have to actually firstly know what the laws and regulations are. And on the other hand, there are, of course, many security requirements which derive from compliance regulations or from laws. And this is also why this aspect is important in this picture. So again, another dimension which shows that the general process of developing security critical software is really very, very complex. And this is why it's no surprise that software today is so insecure, simply because it's such a complex process to develop software which takes into account security. Why UML, as I already mentioned in this lecture and also in much of our work, we have been using UML as a modeling notation, well, simply because it's quite well known in practice, and our goal is to transfer our results to practice and to do technology transfer. Therefore, it's much easier for us to get in touch with practitioners if we use a modeling notation which they already know. But of course, from a technical point of view, you can all, just as well use other notations or use formal methods, for example. And of course, there are disadvantages connected with UML. UML itself is only relatively precisely defined, or depending on your point of view, you might say it's not precisely defined. That is, of course, depends on whether you have a formal methods background yourself or not, how you see that situation. But on the other hand, for the size of a user community, it is actually relatively precisely defined, taking into account that programming languages themselves also usually don't have a formal semantics, at least not a formal semantics defined by the programming language designers themselves. So that is pretty much a similar situation with UML, so there are challenges, but our goal was to overcome those challenges, in effect, to provide a formal semantics for the fragment of UML that we use for this work. So, more specifically, the goal is then to extend the UML notation with, with information that is relevant for security. And this includes the security requirements themselves, but also the security assumptions which I would like to make over, for example, the physical infrastructure or the environment of the system where the software is going to be used. And the goal was then to extend the UML notation in order to be able to easily include this additional information in a UML model of the system for documentation purposes, firstly, but then also develop automated tools which allow you formally verify the UML models, for example, against the security requirements that are included that way. And, for example, with the goal to support in certification, for example, if you want to certify a system against the common criteria, depending on what level you are targeting, it is actually required to provide a semi-formal or even formal model of the system for certification, and this is also something which this approach is supposed to support. So how is this done? Fortunately enough, the UML notation includes extension mechanisms from its early inception, so it's relatively easy to define labels, so-called stereotypes, which allow you to introduce this additional information in the UML models, and also allows you to define constraints, formal constraints, which can then be verified against the models, and we use those constraints to formalize the security requirements that are supposed to be verified against the models. And as I mentioned already, we also defined a formal semantics of a fragment of UML, a simplified fragment to make our lives a bit easier, because the UML notation itself is quite a large and complex notation, but fortunately enough, you usually only use a core part of the notation. And for that semantics, we used a formal method called abstract state machines, developed by Gurevich and others, which allows us to do this in a relatively flexible and convenient way. And again, although I'm going to talk a lot about modeling over the next couple of slides, you have to take into account this is only the core part of the approach, but we also work on ways to link the modeling to the actual source code level and also to provide quality assurance to the actual source code. So challenges which more specifically we would like to address now is, for example, the problem which I mentioned earlier of composability. As I said earlier, in general security is not composable, but of course the goal is to identify preconditions under which certain security properties are indeed preserved under certain kinds of composition. That way we would like to be able to compose secure systems out of components, and maybe even to make secure systems out of components, some of which are not yet secure. The goal is also to view security as a pervasive property, which of course pervades all of the system lifecycle phases and also the architectural hierarchy levels, which I pointed out already, and try to provide an approach which allows you to take all of this into account and nevertheless provide a secure system. And of course, this is not just for academic motivation that this would be nice to have, but this is really very necessary because the attacker is always able to attack the system at a point where he chooses to attack the system. And the problems are usually at the boundaries. So the problems are usually at the parts, as was visualized in that earlier picture. In that case, the boundary between the gate and the rest of the system, namely the meadow next to the street. And this is usually also in IT security where the problems come and where the systems are attacked. So it's really necessary to make that part of the system watertight. Okay, now to finish off the introduction, just a very short walkthrough about the approach in a bit more detail until I then continue with a bit more technical details. But just to finish off the introduction, short walkthrough, we have already seen this overview picture before in a couple of slides ago. I would like to just point out what these various boxes mean in a bit more detail. The first box was about security requirements, and in the context of our approach, this means security requirements elicitation. So what we've been doing there, for example, is to collaborate with people working on requirements engineering and extend one of their approaches, which is visualized in the bottom of the slide here, with the possibility to take into account security requirements. So I will come back to that later in this lecture. Then about models, we have developed tools which allows you to automatically verify the models against security requirements, and I will also come back to that in a bit more details later. Then with respect to the security analysis itself, one of the tools that we've developed is that we've linked a UML modeling environment to an automated theorem prover, which allows you to then automatically verify the UML models for security requirements that are formalized using first order logic. With respect to source code assurance, we've worked on approaches for model-based testing with respect to security requirements, and if I have some time, I will also shortly come back to that part of the approach. But we've also worked more recently on approaches which allow you to verify the source code directly and independently from the models using tools for formal verification of C code in collaboration with Andy Gordon from Microsoft Research Cambridge. If I have some time, I can also mention some results which we've come to there at this point. Then, with respect to analyzing user permissions, we've had a project together with the German banks for which we developed a tool which allows you to automatically verify permissions in the context of SAP systems for security requirements. So I will also shortly have a look at that work. And then finally, with respect to runtime verification, which I mentioned already, we've been extending an approach for runtime verification based on temporal logic model checking, which allows us now to do runtime verification with respect to security properties. And the various approaches are in each case supported by various tools, which I will also come back to in a bit more detail. Tools which allow you on the one hand to verify models against security requirements and also the source code, and then also perform a runtime verification. And if you're interested in this tool support, the URL for where you can download our open source tool is given on the slide. And of course, mentioned as by other lecturers, we will also provide these the lecture notes after the lecture, so you don't have to take notes of that part. So yeah, so much for the overview on this lecture, and now actually a bit more technical detail before we come to the break for today. We'll still start with that. I assume that probably all of you have seen UML already in some way or another. So I will just go through a quick couple of slides as a reminder for those of you that haven't looked at the notation recently. So of course it's a notation originally for modeling object-oriented systems. Of course you can also use it to model systems which are not object-oriented, but historically this is what the notation came from. It allows you to model different views on the system at different degrees of abstraction. It is pretty much a de facto standard for modeling in industry today, simply because so many people use it. And as I mentioned already, fortunately enough, it comes with standard extension mechanisms, which were very useful for us to extend the UML notation for security. As I already said as well, we only use a fragment, the core notation of UML, basically, as I said, to make our lives easier, but also because this is basically what you only need. And altogether, UML is quite a complex notation, but much of that notation is quite redundant. So from my point of view, you only really need the kind of diagrams that are pointed out on the slide. So this is basically what we are concentrating on in our work, because otherwise, of course, the more diagrams you use, the more work you have to develop tool support which allows you to analyze those diagrams. And yeah, also just as a short walkthrough of this use fragment of the UML notation, just to show what the kind of UML models will be that we will see in this lecture, starting from use case diagrams. This is a very simple kind of diagram which simply allows you to specify the use cases that are supposed to be implemented by the system that you want to develop. And this doesn't really contain much information, simply the actors and the activities that are supposed to be supported, and no more than that, so you cannot really do much with that. But of course, from a practical point of view, this is usually the starting point, so we also want to support that. Then, of course, importantly, class diagrams to allow you to specify the class structure of the system. This is something which, of course, plays a central role, and therefore we also use that as well to reason about security requirements. State charts are one core mechanism to specify system behavior or the behavior of components of the system, and because we want to verify the behavior against security properties, we will also make use of state charts for that purpose. Activity diagrams are similar to state charts, but the emphasis is more on the coordinating behavior of the system between different components. Otherwise, they are quite similar to state charts, but for that purpose, they are quite useful. So we also decided to include that in the core notation. Then sequence diagrams, of course, are quite useful to specify methods exchange between different components in the system. And of course, in particular, if you want to analyze the use of cryptographic protocols in the system, then you will make quite a lot of use of sequence diagrams. So this is also supported in our approach. Then more kinds of structural diagrams are the deployment diagrams. These allow you to model the physical infrastructure over which the software is supposed to be implemented. And this is quite useful to document assumptions on the security of those physical infrastructure. So that's why we also use this kind of modeling notation in our approach. And finally, the goal is, of course, to integrate all of those views, because to do the security analysis, you have to take into account all of those views. And fortunately, there is actually a technical means in UML notation to support that integration, which is called UML package or also subsystem. Now this is basically just you just draw a package around a couple of diagrams, and that way you can collect together the various diagrams that are supposed to specify the various views of a particular part of your system. So it's a very simple mechanism, but quite useful in order to collect these different views, because again, the goal is to be able to perform a security analysis which in fact takes into account all of these views in an integrated and seamless way. And finally, as I said already, fortunately enough, the UML comes with standardized extension mechanisms which were quite useful for us to define this UML extension. I already mentioned that briefly. Basically, these are labels which you can include in UML diagrams, most importantly, stereotypes. These are written in double angle brackets, where you can define this label which are written between those brackets, and this you can use to highlight certain parts of the models. And we use that, for example, to express that a certain part of the model should satisfy a certain security requirement by including that security requirement using those labels. Then you also have tagged values, which is an additional annotation which you can use to extend stereotypes with more information. Basically, it's a kind of attribute on the syntactic level, on the meta-model level, which allows you to provide more information for those stereotypes types that you can include in the models. And the third thing is that you can define constraints using, for example, just a plain logic. And these constraints then have to be satisfied by models which are extended with the stereotypes for which the constraints are defined. And this way we can include logical constraints in the models which can then be automatically verified by our tools on the model level. And then you have so-called UML profiles, which are basically a collection of stereotypes, tag values, and constraints, which are defined for a particular application domain. And this is basically what we've done in terms of the UML set profile. This is a profile for the application domain of security, and this is basically also something which is officially possible in UML to define such profiles for specific application domains. Okay, and as I mentioned already, in fact, we did define a formal semantics for the fragment of UML, which I pointed out very briefly. For time reasons, I'm not really going to go into details about that formal semantics. That would basically be a lecture on its own. But every once in a while, I would just show an excerpt of that, which is in fact taken from the book, which I mentioned earlier, just to remind you of the fact that there is some machinery which goes on behind the scenes, even though, of course, this formal semantics is supposed to be encapsulated from the user, because if you remember, our intended user is, for example, a practical software developer who usually don't have a PhD in logic, so we cannot really assume that they know anything about formal semantics, and they don't really care either, and they don't have the time to worry about it. So even though we use formal semantics as a basic to provide a theoretically sound basis for our approach and to make sure that we don't make any mistakes ourselves in our tool development, all of this is completely encapsulated and hidden away from the user, because basically they would be put off by this technical machinery. So basically, but every once in a while I would try to remind you of that machinery. Basically, what this slide points out is just one part of the semantics, namely the part which defines how different components, which you can define using different parts of the UML model, how those components communicate. And of course, they not only communicate in reality, but they also have to communicate in the UML world, so you can define different components using UML models, but then you also have to define how those UML components are supposed to communicate, and this is also something we had to do on the semantics level, of course. But as I said, I'm not going to go into details about that in this lecture for time reasons, but just another short pointer on this formal semantics, which I mentioned already. Just want to mention the kind of formal method we used to define this formal semantics, and this is the abstract state machines developed by Yuri Gurevich and others. We extended that approach slightly to be able to incorporate a certain UML-specific aspects, in particular those communication mechanisms which I mentioned on the previous slide. And the result of that is called UML machine. This is also used in the UML set book to define that formal semantics. But basically, this is just abstract state machines extended with communication mechanisms which are typically used in the UML world. And if you don't know abstract state machines, just on the right side of the slide, just a hint how these are defined. They basically consist of logical rules which can be defined in order to define the semantics of the machines that you want to specify, and these rules are fired when you execute those abstract state machines. So you can simulate those specifications, but you can in fact also formally reason about those specifications, because in fact it is a formal specification approach. But as I said, I'm not really going to go into details about that. I just skip about these across these slides now and come back to UML and security. In fact, the goal of the UML set extension, as I mentioned already, was to allow modelers to include security relevant information in UML models, and as I said already, security relevant information is on the one hand security requirements, it is also threat scenarios. I would like to be able to verify my system with respect to security requirements, but also with respect to different kinds of threat scenarios, because of course it's usually not practical to make a system secure against an arbitrarily strong and resourceful attacker. That would be just too expensive, so that's not realistic. Therefore, I would like to be able to say more precisely what kind of attacker model I have in mind and what kind of threat scenario I have in mind against which the system should support the specified security requirements. So this should also be possible to express that as part of the approach. And then also specialized security concepts such as tamper-resistant hardware or security mechanisms such as access control or cryptographic protocol, security primitives such as cryptography itself, then it should be possible to model physical security properties, or it should be possible to model security management and to be able to reason about that as well. And finally, the goal is to be able to model and reason about technology-specific security concepts such as Java security concepts, smart cards, or Cobra security. And just before the break, just finish this overview. So the general ideas are now that we use the core notation, which I already showed very briefly, the core fragment of UML that we're using here. And for each of the kinds of diagrams, we use this diagram for the purpose that, of course, you usually use it for, to model a system in general. And in each case, we think about how to incorporate security in this particular view of the system and how to verify this view of the system against the security properties that are included that way. And yeah, the result of that, as I mentioned already, is a profile, which again is basically a list of stereotypes, so a list of annotations which you can use to annotate your UML models with respect to security relevant information. And here you can see an excerpt of that profile, so basically a couple of examples for UML stereotypes which we defined and which capture various kinds of security properties that you want to verify on the model level. For example, here you can see the kind of model element that this stereotype is to be attached to. Some of the stereotypes have tags that can be attached to the stereotype, which you can use to add additional information. Many of them have constraints associated with them, which are verified by our tools when you attach the constraint to a particular part of the models. And here are some short description, but yeah, on the next couple of slides, we will in fact look into some of those stereotypes in a bit more detail. As I say on the slide, this is only an excerpt, so the complete list is quite a bit longer, which if you're interested in that, of course, you can have a look at the UML SEC book, but I will not have the time to explain all of them in detail in this lecture for time reasons. But yeah, and the next couple of slides, I will look into some of those stereotypes in a bit more detail, and in particular, look at the tools that we've developed in order to provide a formal verification of the UML models against those security requirements. But before I come to that final motivation, why are we doing this? Well, I have talked a lot about practical motivations. We would like to enable software developers in practice to make their software more secure. But there's also a motivation from a scientific point of view, because you can really use UML to model systems in a rather broad and all-inclusive way. And you can use UML to model various views on the system. This now allows you to ask rather general and broad questions with respect to the different kinds of security requirements that in fact we're going to consider. So this is not just about questions like whether security is composable under certain assumptions, which is something I mentioned already, but there are also other questions. For example, is security preserved under refinement? This is something which we can now analyze in the context of this approach, because in fact we have a formal foundation for the modeling approach. We can now not only analyze a given concrete UML model, but we can also ask questions on the meta level and try to answer those questions in a general way. For example, under which conditions are security properties preserved under refinement or composition or hierarchical decomposition? For example, if you have a stack of software services, each of which enforce a certain security requirements, does this mean that the complete stack will enforce all of the security requirements? Again, unfortunately, in general, the answer is no, but using this kind of approach, we can now exhibit preconditions under which, in fact, the answer is actually positive. And we can do a similar thing with the various UML sex stereotype types. We can reason about how these stereotypes support each other mutually, and etc. So there's a lot of reasoning you can do because, in fact, we provide this formal semantics which I mentioned already. So I think this is probably a good point for a short break. After this break, I will now continue to explain some of the UMLSEC stereotypes in a bit more detail, and then the rest for today will be spent on presenting some of the tools that we've developed to automatically verify UML models for the security requirements that you can include using those stereotypes. Are there any questions at this point? Of course, I forgot to say that, of course, you're very much welcome to ask questions immediately and stop me from talking if something is not clear. But if there are no questions now, then I suggest we have a 5-minute break until 4:05, and then we continue with the second half for today. The earlier we continue, the earlier we're done for today. So let's continue. As I said, I'm going to introduce some of the stereotypes that we have defined for this romantic extension. To start off with, as I said, use case diagrams are kind of diagrams which are not particularly exciting. They only contain very high-level information. Nevertheless, it makes sense to start with them because that's what they usually do with the practical software development. So, of course, here we can then simply include security requirements as security, as a UMLSEC stereotype. This is basically just documentation because in use case diagrams you don't really have any information to reason about, so there's nothing you can do. But nevertheless, we start there as well. And of course, the goal is then whatever security requirement you included there, and I will still explain what I mean by this phase change, that this should also be included in the following UML models, which are provided to provide more detail about the system. And this is what we see on this next slide. So you might, for example, continue by defining an activity diagram which specifies how the workflow is supposed to carry it out, that is supposed to implement those two activities that are seen in that use case diagrams. And this is the activity diagram here, and the requirement or the constraint is now basically that you also need to include the same security requirements as a stereotype at that activity diagram, and technically this is done by including the activity diagram itself in a UML package, which can then be annotated with the prefix change stereotype. And this is just for technical reasons because you need to attach the stereotype at some modeling element, so that's why we define it that way. So again, you have this UMLSEC stereotype for exchange, which you can also use for activity diagrams. And intuitively, this is supposed to mean that the electronic or the transaction that is defined in this workflow is supposed to be fair for both parties involved with the transaction. And for this example, here the customer buys a certain good from a business, and in that scenario, of course, the requirement is that None of the two sides should be able to betray the other side. If the customer pays some money, then he should be able to expect to receive a product or at least be able to reclaim the money. This is basically the requirement on fair exchange from the point of view of the customer. From the business, it's just the other way around. And this kind of requirement can now be documented using this fair exchange stereotype. And with respect to that, there's also a logical constraint that comes with that stereotype, which can actually be verified against the execution semantics of this activity diagram, which basically consists out of a set of sequences of activities that are performed when you execute this diagram. And in order to formalize this fair exchange requirement, what we had to do was to define a start and a stop tag, which allows you to specify basically where the critical phase of the workflow starts and where that critical phase stops. In this case, from the point of view of the customer, the critical phase starts where the customer pays money, and it stops where either the customer can pick up the product or reclaim the money. And one of those two activities should be reached in order for the customer, the fair exchange property should be satisfied. So this is a kind of formalized security requirement, one example where we've actually developed tool support to be able to verify these kind of properties automatically against the formal semantics, the formal execution semantics, which is generated from this UML activity diagram. So how this works is that the user creates the UML activity diagram using their favorite UML editor. They extend the diagram with those annotations. They load the diagram into our tools. And those tools then generate the formal execution semantics that analyze the activity diagram and verify that semantics against the formalization of the security requirement that is included in that picture. And intuitively, the constraint is that, with respect to those start and stop tags which I mentioned, the constraint should be satisfied, which is given on the slide. Of course, this is just an informal description of that constraint, and again, there is a formalization of that requirement on the level of the formal semantics, which again, I don't want to explain in detail here, but the details can be found in the UML spec book. And in this case, in fact, it turns out that this constraint is indeed satisfied by this activity diagram, and you can actually automatically verify that using our tool that is in fact the case. So this was an example for a kind of security property which you can verify on the workflow level by verifying the sequences of activities that are generated by an activity diagram. Now a different view on the system is the view on the communication architecture on which a certain software should be implemented, and this could in fact be a distributed system where you have different nodes in your system which are connected by communication links, these communication links can be of different kinds. It could be internet links, for example. And of course, this information is quite security relevant, because if you have an internet communication link which is not protected, then obviously the attacker can perform certain actions against that communication link, which of course is relevant for a security analysis of the architecture which is modeled. So firstly, we have a couple of stereotypes which allow you to include that information in your architectural deployment diagram, and we will see examples of that on the next slide. But the goal, again, is not only to be able to document that information as part of the UML model, but again also to be able to automatically verify the models with respect to the threat scenarios that derive from those kind of architectural information. And at the same time, we would like to be able to define different kinds of attacker types. For example, you might be concerned with just a plain attacker that is able to access the internet and perform the usual attacks on the internet, but is not able to break into a local area network. And so it is, of course, a very basic attacker, which, at least this is the kind of attacker that one worries about. But one might also, for highly security parts of a company infrastructure, one might also be concerned with internal attackers which are not allowed to access certain parts of that architecture, but which are at least able to access the local area network in general. So they have physical access to the LAN network, even though they are not supposed to access certain information, of course, and that, of course, is a different attacker model from the default attacker who is not able to physically access the LAN connections. And this is the kind of information you would like to be able to model, because it has, of course, an impact on the security analysis, which the tools are then, on the basis of this information, are supposed to be carry out automatically. So in order to achieve that, not only can you define or use these kind of stereotypes that allow you to specify what kind of communication links you have, whether it's an internet link or a local area network link, but with that you can define threat sets that are which basically define for a given adversary type what kind of actions this attacker can do with respect to a certain communication link or a certain system node that is annotated with a given stereotype. So you have, for example, an internet stereotype, which of course specifies that a communication link is supposed to be an internet net link. You have, for example, the default attacker model, and the default attacker can, of course, delete, read, and insert messages on a unprotected internet link. So this is how or why this threat set is defined that way. But with respect to an encrypted internet link, the default attacker is at most able to delete certain messages that are communicating over that link. For example, he's able to bring down a network server, but not able to read or insert the content of those encrypted messages. And this is also something you can define using those threat sets. And with respect to a local area network, the assumption is that a bot attacker cannot access that those links at all. And with respect to a smart card node in the system, the usual assumption is that you have physical security means which would keep an average attacker from successfully attacking the smart card on a physical level. Of course, this is a very relative statement. Usually it's a race between the smart card producers and the very high-end attackers, and every once in a while there are new attacks found against some smart cards, which again the smart card producers try to defend against. So default attackers means someone who can only use the most common attacks and not an attacker which has access to military-grade tools and mechanisms and might in fact be able to break the physical security of a smart card which are still in commercial use today. And of course, you can then vary these definitions. For example, insider attacker would be able to also access LAN communication links, you can do all kinds of variations on that. And again, you have a link to the formal semantics in fact, when I come back to the to the part about the formal security analysis in a couple of slides. What will be important is, of course, what kind of actions an attacker can do with respect to a certain communication link. So this information has to be extracted from the model, and it has to be provided through the formal analysis approach, which again is based on this formal semantics. So as part of the formal semantics, this information needs to be taken into account and is in fact part of the formal semantics model. But first to the next kind of structure. This is in fact still with respect to the communication architecture. We come to an example. Here we see a deployment diagram, which is the user kind of UML model which you can use to specify the physical infrastructure of a system. And this is, of course, a very simple example. You only have two nodes, which are these three-dimensional boxes. In each case, in this example, they have one component contained in each node, and this is the notation for a component. And you can have communication links between nodes, and you can have communication dependencies as part of the logical structure of the system. So here you can see on the one hand the physical infrastructure, these are the nodes and communication links, and on the other hand the logical structure on a very abstract point of view, namely the components and the communication links between the components. And on the one hand, as I mentioned already, you can use UML set stereotype to specify, for example, that a communication link is supposed to be an internet link. And on the other hand, you can also include security requirements on the communication that is supposed to be carried out over this infrastructure. In this case, this communication is supposed to satisfy secrecy. And obviously, this is, of course, a trivial example. In this case, our expectation would be that the tool will come back with the result that, obviously, this is not a secure construction, because you send information over an unprotected internet link, which is supposed to satisfy secrecy, although even a default attacker is able to read messages that are sent over the internet without protection. So, in fact, yeah, it's a trivial example, but in general, of course, your system architecture will be much more complicated, might in fact be nested, or you might have a mobile architecture where these nodes in fact change at runtime. So in general, the situation will be much more complicated, so it is actually quite useful to have automated tools that allow you to check the consistency of this kind of specifications. And how this works on a technical level is, explained informally on this slide. So as we've seen on the example, on the one hand, you can include security requirements in this kind of deployment diagram, and on the other hand, you have information which is derived from the different communication link kinds. Associated, what you then have with this high-level secure links UML set stereotype, this basically formulates the overarching security requirement that the security properties included in the diagram should be supported by the communication links that are used in this architecture. This is basically the requirement that is associated with this overarching security requirement or stereotype secure links, and the constraint that is associated with that is again informally explained on the slide. This is again formalized as part of the formal semantics, and it is again implemented in our automated tools, which then allow you to perform this kind of consistency check automatically on the level of the deployment diagram. And basically, yeah, the constraint is quite straightforward. In the case of secrecy, of course, you should not have the read action as part of the threat sets, because that would obviously destroy secrecy, and with integrity, this is about the insert action. And as I said already, obviously in this very trivial example, it would come back and say that, yes, obviously, the security property is not supported by the released communication. Then another example for a structure on UML sex stereotype is now as part of the UML class diagram. There again, here we can see a simple example for a UML class diagram consisting of two classes, a key generator, which apparently is supposed to implement a cryptographic key generation functionality, and a random number generator, which is supposed to generate the random number that is used within the key generation. Here you can, using this critical stereotype, which is attached to classes, you can, using the attached tags, which are text attached to the critical stereotype, you can then specify security requirements on the various methods and attributes that show up in this class diagram. So for example, the key that is generated by the UK key method is of course supposed to remain secret, and also the random number that is used in the key generation process is supposed to remain secret, because we assume that we use a deterministic key generation algorithm, and then obviously if the attacker gets the random number that is used for the key generation, then they can generate the keys themselves, and therefore this also needs to remain secret. And this is correctly specified in this key generator class model, and the goal is now to have an overall check. This is defined using this new secure dependency stereotype, which allows the tool support to check whether these security requirements are in fact consistent across the whole class diagram. The reason, the motivation for that is, the goal is then that you can give one of those class, or you can give each of those classes two different developers who develop and implement those classes separately without knowing about the other classes. This is the usual idea of divide and conquer in software development. But for that to work, of course, you have to specify in this case also at the random generator that in fact the random number is supposed to remain secret, which is not necessarily obvious, because you might also implement random number generators that are not used for security critical purposes, and there you don't have that requirement. So you need to make sure that this is in fact hardwired, this requirement is hardwired to that class model, because otherwise it might be implemented and used in a context where that is not the case. So basically what the task of the stereotype is now to simply check that the different security properties are consistent throughout the class model. And again, there is a constraint which comes with that stereotype, which just enforces this purpose, namely which makes sure that the security requirements are in fact consistent throughout the class diagram. So, and again, coming back to this very simple example, here it turns out that here this constraint is again violated, because the random generator should also carry this security requirement at the method random, which is supposed to be implemented by random generator, to make sure that the implementer of that class is in fact aware of that requirement and make sure that the random number generator is in fact supports that requirement. So this is again a rather simple consistency check, but now we come to an example for a more sophisticated property on the behavioral level, which is also supported by the UMLSEC approach. And this is the security requirement of a secure information flow. We have in fact seen this kind of security property before in the lecture by Martin yesterday. He provided a formal definition of non-interference, and this is in fact goes in the same direction. It's almost exactly the same definition, but now in the context of the modeling notation of UML state charts. The goal, again, to repeat what Martin already explained yesterday, the goal of this kind of security requirement is to be able to prevent even partial and indirect leakages of secrets. That's the goal of the security requirements. So, for example, if you have a 16-digit credit card number, the goal is not only that the attacker is not able to steal all 16 digits, but it should also not possible that the attacker only gets 10 of them, because he might be able to guess the other 6, taking into account the various algorithms that are available for checking correctness of credit card numbers. Similar scenario is seen in this example here. So again, here we see a very simple UML state chart consisting of only 2 states. So apparently this is about a customer account in the context of a web-based e-commerce system, where a customer can have an account which he can load some money on. So we have a money attribute where the customer can spend money on, and apparently we have 2 states in that account, namely no extra service when the account is opened, and as long as the account balance is below 1,000, it remains in that state, and whenever 1,000 is reached, the customer will get some extra service. Again, using the UMLSEC stereotype critical, we can then associate the security requirements that certain methods and attributes are supposed to remain secret in this class model. So we have the method WM, namely write money, which can be used to write a new amount in that money attribute, and read money, which can be used to read the amount from that attribute. And the attribute itself, and all of these should remain secret. But then we also have another method, RX, which can be used to query the state of the state chart, whether it's an extra service or no extra service. And depending on that, the return value will be true or false. The last thing to explain is that we then have this overarching UMLSEC stereotype no downflow, and the goal of that is now to in fact verify whether this state chart satisfies secure information flow with respect to the security properties that are included in the class model. And well, in this case, you've probably already seen whether that is the case or not. Again, it's a rather trivial example, so you don't even need any modeling or verification tool to see that. Obviously, by reading this public method RX, which is not specified as secret, you can of course see whether the system is in the state extra service or no extra service. And of course, this depends on whether money is larger or smaller than 1,000, which of course is some partial information about the secret attribute money. So this is something, of course, which again you don't need any modeling or verification approach for. But again, in general, you will of course have much more complex behavioral models where it will not be obvious whether that model will satisfy this security property or not. So therefore, it's a useful thing that you can firstly document these kind of requirements in UML models, and again, we have developed automated tools which allows you to formally verify this kind of security properties against the behavior specified in the UML state chart, again on the basis of the formal semantics which we define for that purpose. And again, for time reason, I don't really want to go into detail about those formal semantics, but obviously you have to provide a formalization of the security property, and then you have to verify the formalized semantics whether that that property is satisfied, and the formalization of the security property again relies on the sequences of actions that are generated by this the state chart, and which capture the execution semantics of that state chart. And yeah, I already said that obviously this example violates that security property. Another kind of behavioral verification, which is supported by the human set approach, now actually goes into the direction of verifying cryptographic protocols, which of course we have already heard about quite a lot in this summer school already. Nevertheless, yeah, you will hear a little bit more about that, not so much because the goal is, the idea is that UML is a particular, targeted as cryptographic protocols. Usually, of course, when you develop software, you don't always develop protocols, but you usually develop software which may use protocols, but may not be itself be a protocol. Nevertheless, I will also spend some time on explaining how you can use UMLSEC to specify and verify cryptographic protocols. Sometimes I am being asked why this is in fact the case, why I concentrate so much on protocols. Well, part of the reason is that this is of course a very interesting problem. This is a very compact part of a software architecture, which nevertheless is highly non-trivial. So you can simply write down a couple of messages and you can already make make mistakes, and very non-trivial mistakes in that. And of course this has motivated quite a lot of work in formally verifying crypto protocols. And but of course this is also an interesting challenge in the context of UMLSEC, and this is why I will also spend some time on explaining how you can use UMLSEC in the context of software which makes use of cryptography or makes use of cryptographic protocols. But of course the main target is not so much the protocol verification itself, but rather to verify whether the protocols are in fact used correctly in the system context. And a motivating example which I use in the next couple of slides is in fact a variant of the TLS protocol. This is the current version of SSL, and in fact a variant of TLS which was proposed at the conference Infocom 99, where we made some interesting observations. On this slide you already see a bird's eye view of that, so again a deployment diagram which again specifies a rather simple communication architecture between client and server. Simple class diagram which defines the class models for client and server. Again, a simple activity diagram which coordinates the behavior of client and server. And of course, the central part, a sequence diagram which specifies the core message flow in the handshake part of the protocol. And again, here you can already see the UMLSEC annotations. Again, a secrecy requirement on the core messages and message parts in the protocol, then using the UMLSEC stereotype critical. Here you then also see a use of the internet stereotype, because in fact the protocol has the goal to establish a secure channel over an internet link, and in this case the overarching security requirement is that of data security, which is simply the goal that the cryptographic protocol which is defined in this model supports the security requirements that are annotated through the class model. Again, of course, in order to the goal is not only to be able to document these kind of requirements, but also to automatically verify UML models against the requirements, and for that again we have to define formal constraints, and I will go come back to that and explain that in a bit more detail in the next section of the lecture. But just, and I will also say a little bit more what we found in a good example. Now, just wrapping up the short overview of the UMLSEC notation, coming back at the beginning of this overview, I made a certain number of expectations on an extension of UML, which we would want to be satisfied by an extension of UML that should support secure software development. Basically, now I like to check whether we have achieved those expectations. And yes, we can use UMLSEC stereotype to document security requirements as part of UML models. We can define and reason about threat scenarios using those threat sets, which I've shortly explained. We can use specialized security concepts such as smart cards as annotations, and these will be taken into account at the security analysis phase. And also specialized security mechanisms such as guarded access. I haven't actually shown an example for that for time reasons, but it is in fact also supported. Security primitives like encryption, we will see more of that in the next section. And physical security, as I said already, that can be documented and taken into account on the deployment diagram level. And you can also use the activity diagrams to specify workflows and reason about security management aspects. And in the end, again, this is something I haven't actually shown in this overview for time reasons. We have also some UMLSEC stereotypes which allow you to specifically reason about aspects of, for example, Java and firewall security. Okay, so much for the general overview of UMLSEC, and yeah, for the remaining part of today and then the lecture tomorrow, I would like to zoom into various parts of this overview picture in more technical detail. For today, I can shortly start with that one part which I just hinted at very briefly just now, namely on the model level, how to verify UML models which specify software that makes use of cryptography to make sure that the cryptography is used correctly and in fact supports the security requirements that are supposed to be achieved, which, as we now already know, is in fact a non-trivial goal. So I also don't have to say you more about crypto protocols because we've seen a couple of them in previous lectures in the summer school already. So I will skip those parts basically. Come to the security analysis. This is in fact also similar to what we've already seen in some earlier lectures, but just to recall the kind of security analysis which I will now explain in a bit more detail is based on an old idea by two cryptographers, Dolev and Yao from 82. The idea back then was it should be possible to verify software which makes use of cryptography without actually having to model the details of that cryptographic algorithms on the bit level, but instead to view those algorithms as symbolic black box functions under certain conditions and constraints, and that way we are in fact able to verify large software models automatically and efficiently, which wouldn't be easily possible that way if we would have to take into account all the technical details of the cryptographic algorithms themselves. And so this is basically what is done. Of course, again, now we have to take into account the relevant attacker model in our context. We have to model which kind of communication links the attacker has access to, and we've seen already how one can do that. And the security analysis, which I will explain in a couple of minutes, of course, has to take into account that kind of information. This is basically Dolev Yao. Cryptography is modeled as symbols and symbolic functions, and just very briefly, this gives some details about how that actually works. To achieve that the way we did this year, of course there are many ways of doing that, but the way we did this year was to define a term algebra out of symbolic functions which represent the cryptographic algorithms that are supposed to be used in the specification, such as encryption, decryption, signature, and extraction from signatures. And again, these functions are supposed to satisfy certain assumptions, certain axioms. Obviously, if you encrypt a message and you decrypt it with the correct key, then you expect that you get back the earlier plain text. Otherwise, it would not be very useful. And this we have to specify explicitly on the level of the logical formalization, because this is of course something that has to be taken into account as part of the security analysis, because it is of course a fact with which the attacker will exploit when trying to attack the protocol. Therefore, we also have to take it into account when we build a tool that has the goal to perform a formal analysis. The attacker now basically can eavesdrop on the communication channels that he has access to in terms of the read attack scenario, which I mentioned earlier, and possibly is able to delete or insert messages and compose all messages. I don't have to explain the general idea because we've already seen that in previous lectures. But just very briefly, what I want to explain is the particular approach that we used in this context. And for time reasons, I jump a couple of slides ahead. So the approach which we used in the context of our UML-based verification is an approach based on first order logic. So the goal is firstly to be able to track the knowledge of the attacker to make sure that the secrets that are supposed to communicate it secretly will never get in the knowledge of the attacker. So this should be rather intuitively the formalization of the secrecy requirement in the WPAO style formalization. So again, this is not a secure information flow. We are now not trying to find covert or indirect or partial communication channels. This is not the goal now. Of course, it is an important goal, but we're not trying to achieve that goal now. Instead, we're trying to only worry about the more direct information flows. And this we can in fact do simply by monitoring the set of knowledge that the attacker can build by interacting with the various parts of the system. For example, the various components that participate in the cryptographic protocols. And the way we do this on a technical level is simply by having a sequence of sets, Kn, is a continuously enlarging set of knowledge of the attacker, and whenever a message is sent out to the network, the attacker can read the messages the arguments in that message, and these arguments are then added to the attacker knowledge, provided of course they are not encrypted. If they are encrypted, then of course only the encrypted arguments are added, unless of course the attacker can decrypt the messages, in which case the result of the decryption is also added to the attacker knowledge. So that way we can keep track of the way that the attacker can enlarge its own knowledge, and then again the secrecy requirement can be formalized relative to that security analysis. The value S will remain secret if it never gets into any of those knowledge sets which the attacker can build up continuously. And again, yeah, there is some more stuff going on the underlying formal semantics level. Of course, we somehow need to link those knowledge sets to the actual formal semantics that are that is generated from the UML models. Again, for time reasons, I cannot go into details now, but you just need to keep in mind that there needs to be some functionality which takes care of that link. And then, as I said, the goal is to perform a first order logic based security analysis on the basis of this central idea. So we now need to formalize the relevant information which we need to take into account for our security analysis as a part of this first order logic formalization. We've already seen the first part of that, namely that term algebra which formalizes the cryptographic algorithms and the axioms that are supposed to be satisfied by those algorithms that I already explained. Now we also need to formalize the attacker knowledge which builds up continuously while the attacker interacts with the system. That can be done very simply by using this predicate knows. So a message is included in one of those knowledge sets precisely if the predicate knows E holds eventually after iterating the system behavior. And again, we can use this formalization now to again formalize the security, the secrecy requirements, namely the value S remains secret if it's not possible to derive the statement knows S from the logical formula that represents the behavior of the UML model which specifies the software which I want to verify. And I still have to explain how that generation looks like. That will be done in the next couple of slides. But the general idea is that I have a bunch of first order logic formulas which formalize, on the one hand, the cryptographic algorithms themselves on a high-level symbolic view. On the other hand, the possible interaction, the possible behavior of the attacker. And on the third hand, well, if you have three hands, the intended behavior of the system, which originally is captured in the UML model and from which we will generate a logical formula which in fact captures the formalization of the behavior. And yeah, so as I said, I already showed the logical formula which formalizes the cryptographic algorithms. On this slide, we can see a part of the axioms which are needed to formalize some of the actions which the attacker can perform. And this is the very simple part of that attacker behavior, namely the attacker, of course, can also make use of the functions that he has available. The attacker can decrypt and encrypt messages as long as he has the relevant keys available and can, of course, concatenate decompose messages, and this is all captured in those logical formulas. In each case, with reference to this knows predicate, because again, the goal is to track the knowledge that the attacker can build up by, for example, making use of those cryptographic functions. Then, next, a bit more interestingly, we now want to capture the kind of behavior that the attacker can do while interacting, for example, with the two components that are taking part in this cryptographic protocol. This is the same example we've seen very briefly already, this TLS variant. So assume that we have were given a UML sequence diagram, in this example consisting of two nodes and a couple of messages that exchange between the nodes and a couple of checks which are supposed to be checked before the next message is sent out to the network. Then, also, let's assume that we are given a deployment diagram which specifies the physical infrastructure. In this case, this is just an internet communication link. Then, what we define now is a representation of the possible attacker behavior that the attacker can do in this context by interacting with the two protocol participants in the context of this first order logic formalization. And this is already what we see here on a rather abstract level. I think I actually have an example here. Maybe I first start with the example and then come back to the previous slide. So let's have a look. So the idea is that this specification is supposed to be compiled into a first order logic formula, which is supposed to capture the knowledge that the attacker can build up by a man-in-the-middle attack sitting between the client and the server and eavesdropping on the messages and possibly modifying the messages that are exchanged. So how could this be modeled? The first message is quite easy. The client sends out a message with three arguments to the network unconditionally. There's no check that is done beforehand. This simply means that the attacker gets the three arguments into his knowledge set. So we simply state knows n for the first argument, knows for the second, and knows for the third argument, connected by conjunctions. All of these knows predicates are going to hold, simply because the client will send out that message to the network as specified in the sequence diagram. So that's very simple. The next message is a bit more complicated. What does this mean? So the next message means that the server will send out this message to the network after receiving the first message and after performing that check. But now we have to be a bit careful. Receiving the first message simply means that the server receives a message in it with three arguments. And we cannot be certain that these arguments will actually be the same that the client sent out. This is the whole point of doing a cryptographic protocol and the whole point of doing a security analysis. If we would be able to assume that these messages would not be changed, then we wouldn't need all of that stuff. So all we know is that at this point the server receives a message in it with three arguments which the attacker at this point already has to know, either because they are just the same arguments that the attacker received at this point and the attacker simply forwards to the server, then of course the attacker knows those three arguments and simply forwards them, but the attacker could also substitute those three arguments with some other messages which the attacker already knows at that point. So that's the precondition we need to make here. We need three arguments, and they are now called init 1, init 2, and init 3. These are the three arguments of the message init. And the attacker already needs to know those arguments. And moreover, the arguments need to satisfy that constraint that the server needs to check before sending out the next message to the network. Because otherwise, if that check fails, the server will terminate at that point. So, whatever messages, arguments the attacker chooses to send to the server as part of that message, needs to make sure that this condition will be satisfied, because otherwise things will stop there. But if that's the case, then what the attacker gets is the next message and the two arguments in that message, which again are constructed using arguments of the first message which the server received. So we don't actually know whether init 1 will be n, because the attacker might have changed it. So here we only say init 1, just to be very explicit about that. All we know is that the attacker now receives these two arguments, and here for space reasons I didn't spell them out, but basically you just have to copy those two arguments In this part of the implication, namely the postcondition of the implication, which simply means that when the attacker successfully brings the server to answer that message, the attacker will, as a result of that implication, receive two more messages in his knowledge set. And the third message will go the same way, but just the other way around, so I leave it out on the slide. So basically we can continue like that, and this is basically the whole thing that this formalization says on the slide, except that of course we have to make sure that at the post condition of each such implication we need to include the next, the formula which is supposed to formalize the next message in the sequence diagram. So this is how this is defined here. Of course, this relies on the implicit assumption that the order of these messages are in fact enforced by both message participants, which is what you usually assume in the case of cryptographic protocols that are executed over the internet, for example. However, there are situations where that isn't actually the case, and there was an interesting application where we run into that situation when we looked at this biometric authentication system, which I mentioned earlier. Part of the system was implemented on a smart card, and the communication with the smart card worked in a way that the smart card just waited for a message from the host system and answered to that message, and the smart card didn't really care what order of the message the host system followed. So if you have a specification like that, if this is the smart card, or let's say if that is the smart card and these two messages were ignored, the smart card would be happy to just receive the third message and would continue with the protocol despite the fact that something is missing. And if you have that situation, then in fact you have to change this formalization, and I will explain that later. It's a very small change. The whole thing that changes is that this bracket will be up there instead of down there. And this already changes that behavior in a very subtle way, but it makes a huge difference on the security analysis. So this is one instance of a remark which I meant, which I made earlier, that all of this verification stuff always relies on the assumption that you capture the behavior of your environment and the behavior of the underlying physical infrastructure correctly, and if you make a mistake there, then basically the security analysis may not be very useful. So of course this is an obvious remark, but it's very useful to remember that every once in a while. And yeah, this was in fact an interesting point there, and I will come back to that again tomorrow. Talking more tomorrow, I think we're pretty much done for today. So I will just finish, basically skip through these slides very quickly to get you close today. Here you see now actually a more complete fragment of the logical formalization, which is now in fact automatically generated by our tools from the WML model. And what is then done is that these logical formula are fed into an automated theorem prover, which can then automatically verify whether the security conjecture, which was also generated, can be derived from those logical axioms. So the way this works in the case of secrecy, as I mentioned already, was that the tool checks whether the statement knows of S can be derived from the axioms, some of which I explained in the last couple of minutes. And if that is the case, that means that secrecy is violated. So we're not trying to, in the sense, we're not trying to verify secrecy, but we are trying to verify a successful attack. And if we get a proof found, this means that in fact there is a successful attack. So we have to think the other way around from what you usually do in this kind of approach. And in fact, what this meant was that There is in fact an attack scenario against this variant of TLS, which was proposed at Infocom 99. I don't have the time now to explain in detail how the attack works, but it's a typical man-in-the-middle attack where the attacker firstly exchanges some of the public keys and certificates, and that way is able to capture the session key and therefore then also the secret. And in fact, there's a relatively straightforward fix, and the nice thing is that we're now able to also verify automatically that this fix in fact is satisfies the security the secrecy requirement as stated. Okay, so I just about managed to get finished for today. So tomorrow we will then talk a little bit about some general results, some of which I already mentioned today. It's questions such as under which conditions is security preserved under refinement or composition. And then I will try to cover as much as possible of the remaining topics, such as how to link the model-based security analysis to the code level. Runtime verification I will also look into, and certainly software evolution, and then depending on time also talk a little bit about some applications. Are there any questions for today? Otherwise, I assume everyone is as tired as I am. Sorry about running over, but I really want to finish this, and so we can relax more tomorrow morning. And then see you tomorrow.